I'm Mike Asnald, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Carrie Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoy the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
All right, I'd like to welcome our AC23 Plus listeners to another session. I'm Mike Esnault, the Director of Arts and Education here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge, and today I have an old friend, probably going on 35 plus years, Mr. Jeff Ford. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, and so when I first met you, you were still in high school.
Yeah, I must have been getting close to finishing up.
And you were playing with I forget the band's name, but it was a good band, like a show band.
The band's name was Wavelength.
Was that Charles Anzalone?
Yes, the drummer? It was. Okay. Yes, yeah.
So I think the first time that I kind of ran into you, they were recording at a studio, small 16-track studio.
In your home, right?
No, it was at Randy McAllen.
Oh, that's right.
Wow. And then I remember seeing you play, and it's like, oh, put a pin in that guy. He's somebody I can use for commercials.
Man. So that would have been probably 86, 87. So going on close to 40 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it confirms we're both getting old.
Right.
Well, I wanted to bring you on, Jeff, and talk to you about lots of different things, but you have a long history, and first and foremost, I first met you as a musician,
mm-hmm. Right.
A guitar player, songwriter, composer, and during that time, especially in those early years, we worked together in different capacities, much of which was doing commercials,
yep.
Or documentary films, you know, but creative music endeavors.
Right, right.
And you know, I really appreciate that because, as you said, I was very young and had no experience in that. Yeah. And so it was a lot of fun for me to kind of get involved in a lot of the parameters of that, you know, with like deadlines and technology and all that kind of stuff.
Right, but kind of learning to write to time, or, you know, we were using early sequencers. And, you know, when you're writing to picture, you know, tempos have to change so you can hit a spot. And
right.
All these things that are so foreign to musicians who aren't in that game, mm-hmm. That it's, you know, and I was just learning it when you were learning it, you know, we were really early at the change of technology, because we just had sequencers at that point and some samplers.
Mm-hmm. That was the time, right about the time the Mac SE, the little box Mac, came out.
Right.
So I know we were using that and some of the early sequencing programs, yeah. And whatnot.
So we did, you and I did, you know, a lot of scores, and then, and then I think prior to that, I think some of the first stuff I ever got hired for was for Playmakers. I was writing music for some of their shows.
Right.
And then I think I did a couple of their tours as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was all kind of the that type of art form. And I was thinking about it today. I was like, how did I write, you know, for the shows that were already kind of set? I just went and watched. And I think I made notes and then went, mm-hmm. and figured stuff out and then came back and see if it would fit or.
Right.
And I remember also kind of performing at the shows where, you know, you were kind of playing things off of the computer, mm-hmm. sequences. And
right.
Sequencers allowed me, who I have no facility as a piano player at all, mm-hmm. it allowed me to kind of compose stuff by step writing, you know, just
right.
note to note to note, and then speed, mm-hmm. things up, slow things down. And that was a really great experience, working with Playmakers, just, you know, just another realm to kind of write in,
mm-hmm.
That you get to be super creative. And then it also dictates sometimes the type of music that you're doing, which carries through in films. We always see that in documentary films. I mean, we cover a lot of ground musically,
yeah.
Or in commercials. Then you have to really cover a lot of ground in 30 seconds and make things, again, hit. And I forgot how, for a lot of people, that's hard to execute.
Yeah.
They're not used to it. Or I'd have friends who were real live musicians and, mm-hmm. performers who couldn't understand, you know, the idea about having something that's complete in 30 seconds, you know, that's a complete song, if you will.
Right. So. Well, and that kind of illustrates, you know, your one of the things I wanted to talk about early on in the interview was your background. Like, it, to be able to do all those things you just talked about,
right,
you have to have a certain level of musicianship and training and whatnot. And many of the people I've talked to on this series are born and bred Baton Rougeans.
Right.
And they've, you know, I'm always interested in, like, how they, number one, got into music, but then their training in music.
Yeah.
And so how did you first get into music?
So when I was in second grade, I had to have, they found I had some problem with one of my kidneys was in really bad shape. And I was super into sports. I was way heavily into football. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a second grader, third grader, that's what I, you know, was really focused on. And then when I had this, I had a surgery, and they told me then, and it wrecked me, is you can't play football. And so then.
At second grade.
At second grade. It was, but then at about fourth grade or fifth grade, that's when tackle leagues were started, mm-hmm. in other words. So in second grade, there weren't that many tackle leagues. It was just, you know, just street football and all that stuff. Yeah. Anyway, since I couldn't play and all my friends were playing, my dad, I think, at some point, because he liked the guitar player at, I think, the Village restaurant. It was a guy named Al Polo.
Oh, okay, yeah. I know that name.
And he, my dad said, you know, try guitar, and I'll bring this guy over, and see if you like it. And I loved it,
yeah.
You know, immediately. And so, and then consequently, I had an older brother who exposed me to a lot of music that I wouldn't have found as a, you know, a fifth or sixth grader. So, mm-hmm. you know, there was a lot of stuff that he played, more in the rock and prog rock kind of realm, not so much in the jazz and things. And so I started playing in fifth grade, taking lessons, and then, you know, recognizing kind of like, oh, I've kind of outgrown this first teacher. And, you know, so you kind of seek out the next teacher.
Sure.
And so I had a second teacher and then kind of went past, you know, kind of him ultimately, and then got another teacher, James Dawson, who was kind of the jazz gateway for us. But fifth, sixth, seventh grade, and then by seventh grade, I knew I wanted to have a band. You know, I wanted to, so I convinced one of the neighbors down the street, you know, to get some drums. And then I remember there was this kid I saw on the Buckskin Bill show playing Bad Bad Leroy Brown. and he was a great singer. And I saw him in sixth grade. We were at different elementary schools. And then we met at Broadmoor in seventh grade. Mm. And I was like, oh, we got to have a band with him. And so I had him on board. And then we brought in another guy who, we were just friends. He didn't play anything. Made him the bass player.
Okay.
And so I remember, you know, like the first gig we ever had. There were pictures of it. You could see him just staring at my hands to kind of figure out where to be. We had pyrotechnics, so we had emptied out a bunch of bottle rockets into little glass things, mm-hmm. little glass containers, and so we. We're playing Jimi Hendrix, like Purple Haze, and the other two guys that weren't playing at the time lit the things, and we were in somebody's house, you know, low ceiling house.
You're doing this inside.
Inside gig. It was Kiss. You know,
yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Kiss inspired.
Yeah. That would have been that time, right?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Late 70s, something
yep.
like that.
Yeah, yeah, probably 76, 77, right. and all that stuff. So, you know, and with that band, Funfair Park was a venue. It was a. You know, kind of where it was an amusement park that later became Blue Bayou and all that stuff.
Right.
But it was, you know, Florida and Airline, and they would have bands on the weekends, you know, and radio station, you know, would be there broadcasting, and the bands would go in and do interviews on the radio. And so, you know, we had our band that got,
what was the name of the band?
Odyssey.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, that was sort of my roots, and then started getting more and more serious about it. And got interested in jazz. Well, also what used to happen is that Broadmoor High would come to the elementary school with their big band. And so that was also a mind blower. Fifth and sixth grade, those bands were phenomenal.
Right.
They had drummers. I remember, like, I think Jeff Boudreaux.
Oh, yeah.
You know, J.R. Miller playing trombone. I mean, in other words, there were these guys who were just world-class, and Lee Forche was the band director.
Right.
And he was at Broadmoor, and I was like, perfect. I'll just file right into, you know, to Broadmoor High School, right from Broadmoor Junior High, so I can kind of be in that, you know, that noise that they made, that big band sound.
So you got
was
the, kind of the bug.
I definitely had the bug, yeah. All while still having the prog rock bug for bands like Yes or for the Dixie Dregs or, you know, all these, right. All these, you know, unbelievably talented musicians playing complicated music.
Sure.
You know, but yet seeing Forche, you know, as a fifth and sixth grader, because they would come each year, just blew, you know, and the bands, I think they were fantastic. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I don't know if it was because I had no exposure to it, but it was a small stage, and so it was just powerful.
Right.
And so Lee Forche, who was renowned, you know, as an educator and a tough guy, he had had a stroke. And then I think when he recovered from the stroke, he was hired to teach at Baton Rouge High.
Right.
In the first years of the magnet school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so kind of getting into the jazz side of things, and I, you know, went to that school in 10th grade, auditioned for Forche, and, you know, it was just a pig and slop. I mean, just so happy to be there, and just, I was now part of that sound, you know.
Right.
And also then getting kind of a tough drill sergeant education, you know, a lot of you mothers and you'll never be great because you've never had to suffer. That was his message to most of us. And he was kind of right.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, we did have some people who've gone on to, you know, tremendous levels of success. But, you know, he thought you definitely needed to suffer.
Right.
And so, you know, that led me through high school into kind of more a wider array of music. So now I like really the prog stuff, but then Miles was huge. A young Pat Metheny, you know, who was like 19 and 20 years old when we first heard him, also was a, you know, big influence, you know. And so that kind of brought me to high school. And, you know, I can tell you where I went from there, or, you know, just...
Well, when you were at high school, so you had Lee Forche there. Was Johnny Gerbrick also there?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, okay. The two of them were the, you know, they would have their coffee together every morning when we show up. They've got their thermoses out, the coffee's ready, and then, you know, then, and Mr. Gerbrick would come into our, you know, to our room, to the Lee Forche's, you know, the stage band room. Yeah. And then he would go and handle all the concert, everything else, all the concert bands. And so he was there, and Mr. Forche was there. And, you know, we were preceded. Some big influences are some guys that were there before me. Jim Odom was a huge.
Presonus Jim Odom. Yeah. LaRue.
Right. LaRue Jim Odom. Presonus Jim Odom. You know, and when we say, you know, I mean, that was his company that he built.
Yeah.
Ground up.
That's his
into
baby.
A major. You know, just a major music company.
I mean, brilliant guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was super cool. He, you know.
So we all, did y'all like kind of tail end
each
other?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, his senior year would have been my sophomore year.
Okay.
And kind of that chair was mine. And, you know, for the 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then behind me was Wendell Tilley.
Oh, yeah. Another great guitar player. Yeah.
And so, you know, there were just tons of really talented people, you know, that played in those bands and that. You know, got an education, you know, in so many areas, you know, of music from Mr. Forche.
That's one thing about, you know, a school like that, Baton Rouge High, and of course there are other ones in the city, but there's almost a culture created because of, if you have those key instructors, those teachers.
Right. And it was also, you had the kids that wanted to be there.
Right.
I mean, you know, we left our neighborhoods because we wanted to go there. We wanted to go where Forche was.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a conservatory in a way.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, for better or for worse, like I probably couldn't survive at Baton Rouge High today academically, you know, as strong as it is.
Yeah.
And then at that time, you know, it was rigid academically, but He would have people slide in, you know, because, you know, he saw their musical talent. So if they weren't super strong academically, he'd get them in.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, we have a mutual friend of ours who brings up that point every time we talk about Baton Rouge High. Like, if it wasn't for my ability to play music, there's, you know, in Forche, like, demanding, basically, that he be at the school.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have gone to that school.
And if we're talking about the same person, that Forche wanted him at some point to come live with him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, to come live with him, you know, so he could keep an eye on him because he was supernaturally talented. I
mean, right.
Naturally talented, you know, just, you know, and as we also well know, sometimes the people with the most talent can get a little relaxed with it.
Sure. Yeah.
And then sometimes the guys with a little less talent can find their way, you know, to areas that they can succeed in
right.
because they grind.
Right.
And I would put my, I'm kind of in that realm of somebody that was a grinder. I was never somebody that loved performance.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And I did sort of discover that through bands. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was great as an eighth grader, but then as it started coming to what's this going to look like as I leave high school,
right?
You know, what's that world look like?
Yeah, to the comment you made about the talent and people with different levels of talent and what they do with it. I remember reading an interview with Bill Evans, the great jazz pianist, and he makes that comment when he was younger. He, you know, he's a legend, you know, one of the great jazz pianists of all time. But he said when he was in high school, he wasn't the most talented guy in school, you know, and he would see these guys who had more talent, but he just had this drive and work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, over time started to surpass all these guys.
Right.
I guess maybe because they were so talented, they didn't. It was a detriment to their work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But
yeah,
but I've seen that too, just as an educator for many years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you saw, and you still see this to this day, is that technology changed and made somebody like me able to kind of do things that I could hear, mm-hmm. but I didn't have the facility to execute. Mm-hmm. And so those sequencers allowed me to slow things down, experiment with string sections and, you know, all this stuff kind of as a two-finger musician, just kind of using my index fingers to kind of, you know, tap out and record drum beats. And
right.
know. And then
right.
we've seen that just, you know, grow and grow and grow as mm-hmm. technology's changed.
Yeah. Well, so you finish up in high school, and then I know you've had experience working as doing sound. Was it the producers that you were working with?
I went out. I only mixed a few shows with them, and then I was kind of just in the crew. I mean, I was like a roadie. Mm-hmm. You know,
okay.
I was hauling gear and setting up, you know, amps and because my friend Tim Smith mm-hmm. had gotten the gig with the producers.
He was playing bass with them.
He was playing bass with them. And they were a band, for people who don't know, were one of those bands that we all looked at and said, how come they're not huge?
Right.
How come they are not a massive pop band? And there are reasons, and you know, you can go, if you're really interested, you can go hear interesting dark tales about the music business.
Right, right.
But I went out on the road for probably a year, year and a half. And it, what it taught me is I don't want to be on the road.
Hmm.
You know, too much downtime, you know, just driving. And
right.
So I did learn, you know, that, okay. And so that's where one of my other influences came in. We had a band together at the end of my high school, which was Jim Odom.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim was the first person that I knew who had recording equipment.
Mm.
And so he had like an 8-track in his barn, you know, at their house. And so that's where you go and play and, you know, you kind of learn the basics of recording and bouncing tracks down, you know, taking 5 channels with drums and bouncing it down to 1 and then giving you space to record more parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that post high school, I started kind of looking for ways to write for people and then looking, you know, buying equipment to record, you know, because big studios weren't available to us and they were so expensive.
Sure.
And even the 8-track, you know, that gear was so, it was expensive. So it was like work, save, you know, get somebody to, you know, kick in a few bucks and help us buy an 8-track recorder.
Right.
You know, and so that kind of began that next stage of kind of being an engineer.
Well, and is it fair to say that the skills that you developed in recording, very much self-taught?
Yeah, because there was there were a few schools, and it was before Full Sail.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and so then it would be knocking on some doors of people who had big studios here, you know, 24-track studios, and saying, you know, hey, can I please do some work here? And one of the guys was a consistent no, and then another one of the guys was yes, and so I got to spend some time, you know, in some of the larger studios with bigger consoles, but also just left to the wolves, you know, just like right. you've still, they weren't teaching. They were like, here, figure it out. Right. Here's the manual mm-hmm. and kind of figure some of that stuff out. So yeah, lots of trial and error and lots of, you know, growing with the technology of the time.
But as you said, you enjoyed, you'd been on the road, so yeah. you knew what that was, and yep. you preferred sort of
right.
what was you were starting to carve out as a life at home
yes.
in music.
Yep. Yeah, and absolutely, because then I also knew, recognized toward the end of my high school years that I'm not that interested in performing. It's right. not, I just didn't have that, mm-hmm. you know. But I did love coming up with stuff, and I did like
the creative process.
You know, the creative process, and then finding people like yourself who I was like, oh, you know, I saw chess pieces. Like, wow, mm-hmm. this is somebody that can do things that, you know, he's got a skill set, mm-hmm. you know, and I can use that. And then a crystal ball,
right.
you know, early crystal ball. Yeah. It's like, oh, we need mm-hmm. somebody that can play slide guitar. And we, you know, Chris was a few years younger. He may be your age.
I think we're close, same age.
Yeah. And so, you know, and so that was thrilling and really fun, you know, just to kind of, it was chess pieces. And then I realized, oh, you know what? I think I'm a producer, mm-hmm. you know, and it's kind of what is my core to this day is kind of producing and directing.
Right. Right. And I would agree because, I mean, having worked with you, I would always admire that about you. Like if we were working on a commercial, being able to see kind of being able to get into the weeds and deal with whatever it was, but also kind of step back and have a more macro look at things and,
right.
you know, how it really all needs to come together conceptually.
Yeah.
And that is a producer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and carried through in that realm and doing, you know, some records here and there, and then going to Nashville a little bit and doing some recording up there mm-hmm. and getting to kind of see those guys and how ridiculous, you know, the A-level players were in their lanes, you know, and just shockingly good
right.
Musicians, mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, if you were into sports, it's like, you know, those guys were like NFL players and, you know, and everybody else is, you know, junior high players, mm-hmm. you know, and just that was an eye opener as well, just how quickly they could turn things, how creatively, but again, different skill set, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that brought me to where, you know, and as technology then sort of changed, you know, I went through periods where I was writing a lot of music for documentaries and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I started realizing that I really like the smaller form better. I like the short. I right. like the 30-second commercial.
Right.
It's quick turn. It doesn't take you as much time.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I realized too, like, you know, it's like, well, Mike, you know, Mike is built more for long form than I am. He can get across mm-hmm. And get many places faster. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, long form pieces would take me a really long time, you know, because I just didn't have the mm-hmm. skill level. 30 seconds, I can hang. You know?
We'll talk a little bit about, like, we're talking about music and production and all that, but, you know, if you're going to work in post-production, like you said, commercials,
right?
There's a lot more to it than that. I mean, there's just so many hats you have to wear, and I think part of it, and I always thought this was interesting, I think there's a psychology part of it, too, like dealing with clients
yes.
who very often don't know anything about music. Maybe they have good instincts.
Right.
Or you have the other scenario where they think they know a lot about music and they have horrible instincts.
And
but,
either
but
way,
you have to navigate all
and
that.
And either way, you have to navigate them. You have to kind of figure out how to interpret what somebody who can't articulate in a musical way what they want,
mm-hmm.
How to articulate that. And then there were slings and arrows in that realm as well, where you'd kind of, I remember getting hired by one of the well-known political consultants and working all night to kind of interpret his language mm-hmm. of what he wanted this 30-second spot to be. And so I remember riding all night, and then we'd get in the car and drive, you know, down to WBRZ at mm-hmm. 5 o'clock in the morning to deliver a tape mm-hmm. that then they sync up with the picture. And then I go home and put my head down to go to sleep, and I get a call, and this guy just says, failure. Absolute failure, son. Click.
Right.
Oh, man, that's gutting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you also find out that guy's kind of, you know, a bit of a blowhard.
And, right, right.
But you still, and that's another part of this working for, you know, the corporate world or for industrial films or for commercials, you've got to kind of have a thicker skin and not take things personally. Mm-hmm. And we're not writing, you know, music in this regard. We're not writing music for ourselves. We are.
It's not concert hall music.
No, it is. It's commercial endeavors at the behest of, you know, what the client, making the client happy, right, but yet still trying to deliver. And I think you and I went through this stuff too, where if we would do ideas for somebody, we'd do like an idea that we really love, right, and then an idea that we think is okay, and then a throwaway item that we can't stand.
And how many times did that third one
get chosen? And the third one gets picked all the time. And so, you know, I don't know if that's a result of, you know, being kind of jazz snobs or kind of complex music snobs, because I do go back and I've listened to certain things that we did and I realize, oh yeah, I see why they hated that, but I wasn't. I was trying to still bring what I like into their world.
Right.
And it's really, you've got to take their world and kind of find, mold something that you can still like, but that works for them.
Well, yeah, and there's that business side of things.
Yeah.
You know, I have one of my favorite stories to tell people. I had done something once, and it was a theme for a thing. And this is back in the times of DAT tapes.
Right.
So I had laid it off, just out of courtesy, I had laid it off the same piece of music four or five times, so it didn't have to get cued back whenever, you know, all the cooks are in the kitchen, right, and they're trying to decide if they like it or not. So, and I forgot to tell them. So the thing just keeps running, and it plays all four, right, five of the same thing, and then someone, you know, who has to, you know, put their foot down and like, yeah, yes, I like that, Mike. I think version number three,
right,
is the one we're going with. And I'm like,
yeah.
Oh my God, I could really bust this guy right, yeah, now. But then you play the game, you know?
Right.
And, you know.
Right. Yeah, I had a variation of that game called the Dead Faders game, where there was an act, and the guy was just showboating so much, and he had an audience, you know, there with him. And so he was telling me to bring stuff up, you know, 2.5 dB or half a dB or 0.4 dB. It was just
right,
kind of ridiculous.
Kind of silly.
And so I gave him his own set of faders, said, here, why don't you just control it yourself? And the faders were dead. They weren't controlling
non-functional,
anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he would kind of, yeah, you know, this sounds much better, right? You agree? And so that was the equivalent. The dead faders just where. Those are things you really shouldn't. That's very unprofessional. But sometimes you just get to the point, you know, where you just had to kind of have a little bit of a, at least internal relief from the ridiculousness sometimes.
Right, right.
So,
well, I know, like, both you and I, but especially you, because you kind of really stayed in those trenches longer than me, but the way the industry has changed over the years, and I know back in those early years, yeah, there would be situations where people were asking, hiring for a lot of original music.
Right.
Almost out of necessity, because you didn't have the resources of music libraries,
right,
and, you know, all those kinds of things.
And the ones that were available were super expensive, really, really expensive.
Right.
So.
And then it was kind of, you know, talk to that a little bit. Like, when did that start to change? Maybe in the 90s, late 90s?
Yeah, I think with technology and the cost, the barrier to entry into this field started to kind of change as things got cheaper, mm-hmm, on into the 2000s.
Right.
And I think in the 2000s, then you started seeing the birth of music libraries, where you could do a lot with a music library, mm-hmm, if you knew how to edit it. And that's something I got good at. But it was also killing a portion of the local, scoring, you know, because
right,
we scored a lot of stuff locally. Bank,
yeah,
commercials and just all kinds of stuff.
Right.
Hospitals and there's still, you know, some of that that goes on. But the music libraries got really, really good and broad and deep, and then allowed people to not have to spend as much money. And then consequently you and I wrote
for them. If you can't beat them, join them.
That's right. That's right. And so, and it's fun because you'll hear some music that you wrote show up on Monday Night Football, or I just like kind of catching some of those things that we did. Where you'll hear them on, or you know, on different shows, American Idol, or they're in countries all over the world.
Right. The fun thing for me is to sit down, and I'm sure you do it too. You read your BMI sheet, and you see where it was played and what it was used,
right,
for. Sometimes I wonder, is this an adult film or not? I'm
right,
not sure, but either way.
And Mike's talking about BMI, and so, that's when you get your royalty checks, mm-hmm. And it gives you a listing of how your music's been used. And the stuff that we did was, we did like a New Orleans jazz record.
Right.
And it is fascinating to see all the places it's played, you know, and but, you know, it'd be like 0.01 cent or 2 cents or 26 cents, you know. In Norway, it's on this show. And
yeah, we're not moving to Monte Carlo on this kind of stuff.
No. But it is fun. It was really fun to see just the worldwide reach of that.
Sure.
You know, so.
Well, Jeff, listen, I want to thank you for being a guest here today. And it's always a pleasure to kind of catch up and talk about things. And
We've had a long history that we did probably more things together that we remember. Especially back in the early days.
So. Absolutely. I was just talking about it. I was like, oh, wow, we did that. We did that. So lots of fun. And thanks again. And just wishing you all the best in the future, man.
All right. Thanks for having me.
The Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.